This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
The book known as the Letter to the Hebrews. The Letter to the Hebrews. What kind of book is this? Well, you'll have to go back and listen to last week's. I intro'd the book and gave you all the background and all the details. I'll mention it here in just a minute, but it is, you know, it's back there around the Timothys and James, if you want to find it. But, of course, I provide you these nice large print on the screen. And we're going to burrow in, but here it is. It'll sound familiar if you were here last week. It opens with these words. This is the very start of the book of Hebrews. Let's read it right here. It says, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers through the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom He created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God. He is the exact imprint of His nature. And He upholds the universe by the word of His power. After making purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as superior to angels as the name He has inherited is more excellent than theirs. This is the word of God. Now, last week, we talked a little bit about what this book is, because you want to have a little bit of overview. I mean, you can always just open a book and just start. But I thought I should, you know, let us know a few things by way of some background. So we discussed, for example, the very fascinating age-old question about the exact authorship of Hebrews. And of course, we resolved it completely. No, we did not. I just laid out for you what all the smartest people have said throughout all the years about who it might have been. But we just really don't know. But the point is, it doesn't matter all that much. The fact is, as we said, the church recognized this as inspired and authoritative from the earliest days. They quote from it, and so it's always been thought of that way, and the author didn't want to be known, or he would have said, Paul, an apostle. I mean, some people say it. Maybe it's Paul, but for whatever reason, if it was, he didn't want to say so this time. But whoever it was, it assumes some things about the readers. It's to the Hebrews. Does that mean it's to Jews? Not necessarily. Although it's cool if Jews read it, because it's an apologetic for Christ as the Messiah and His fulfillment. But it was mostly written to believers, but they were believers who would have completely known and understood the Jewish background. It's very, very theological. And we said, what is its main theme? And I laid it on you pretty easy. The main theme of the book, I'll show it to you again, is just simply this. It's right out of the opening lines that we just read. The writer cuts to the chase, doesn't beat around the bush, and lets you know right up front what this book is about. It is a Christ-exalting book. It says that the Messiah is the Messiah. I mean, He's the appointed and anointed one, the Christ, but that He's a whole lot more. In fact, that He's the complete fulfillment of everything, is the long and the short of it. So that everything that all the Scriptures would have pointed to would be fulfilled in Him. That's the theme of the book. He surpasses all else. Everything in the Old Covenant, He surpasses, He completes, He fulfills. So that includes every great hero of the Old Testament, like all the guys like Abraham, who's the great granddaddy of them all. If anyone celebrated Father's Day, it had to be Abraham, whose name after all meant, I mean, you know, right? The father of a whole lot. I don't know if any of you are the father of a whole lot. At least you're the father of a few. But he is the father of a whole lot. But Jesus is greater than him. Moses. But he surpasses Moses. David, the great, mighty King David. But he's better than David. Elijah, I mean, the main man among the prophets. But no, greater than Elijah. Greater than all those people. Higher and greater than the angels, as it just said, even. Everything involved in the worship of God that was held to be important and sacred and valuable, like the temple. But he's greater than the temple. In fact, the temple, he even said, this thing's going to, you know, it's going down. And it did go down in the year 70 and never went back up. He's greater than the temple. He went into the heavenly temple. By the way, all of this stuff that I'm saying, it's all played out. I'm not just extrapolating this from a couple of verses. I've already read the whole book, see? And some of you have, so you know that all of this is explained in later chapters in greater detail. He's greater than the priesthood, including even the high priest, which is the highest, you know, office of the priesthood, and only he could go in, you know, to that holy place and do the sacrifice. But Christ is greater than, he's the ultimate high priest, greater than all the sacrifices, which were in the end ultimately insufficient because the blood of bulls and goats and so on, they aren't they aren't fully, finally capable of really removing sin. The rituals, the law, the feast days, everything they loved the most, everything that was, you know, divinely revealed as part of what they ought to do. This book says that the Messiah is greater and that he fulfills and that he surpasses all that stuff. That's what it says. So this a key trademark of this book then is what the theologians would have called a high Christology. That was what they would have called it. A high, it means a very, very exalted view of Christ. It's hard to get a higher one than what this book presents. But I want to zero in now on one section of a verse in particular. Because, so we got overview. I just gave you like the grand sweeping overview of the whole theme. All right, so this is kind of how we do good biblical interpretation. You see the forest, and then you look tree by tree. That's how it works. That's how a good interpretation works. You look at the whole thing, and you look at the tiny parts. That's why if someone says, oh, I think the best way to read the Bible is entire books at once. Just sit down and read a whole book. And the other guy says, no, that misses too much. You got to, every day you just look at like one tiny piece, and you dig into it. And the fact is, both of them are right. Both of them are right. Because how can I understand the whole book accurately if I don't carefully know? You know, the forest and the trees. I know the forest better if over time I've inspected every single tree. Then I really know the forest. But I can understand every tree better in its context of the forest. Am I making sense here? So that's what we're doing. So I gave you the whole big overview. But now I'm going to really, you know, magnifying glass right on in on this one section. And here's a handy way you can sometimes do this. You can look across various English translations. So let's look at a couple of pages worth here of some translations I'll provide you. I want to show you what different English translators, translation committees did with this section I want to focus on here that we read. Now, we looked at the ESV. It said, he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. That's what it said. But let's look at some others. Here's what the old King James guy said. Who being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person. You see that even the sentence structure, the way they did it, was a little different. And here's the New American Standard. It says, and he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. And here's the NIV. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. I got a few more. The Old Revised Standard, RSV version, says, he reflects the glory of God and bears the very stamp of his nature. How about that? Bears the very stamp. Now, here's the semi-popular contemporary version here called The Message. It says, the Son perfectly mirrors God and is stamped with God's nature. And a similar kind of paraphrase as the New Living says, the Son radiates God's own glory and expresses the very character of God. And here's a bonus for you. Tyndale, with the original spelling. Because, you know, Tyndale did this before, sort of standardized spellings. And we talked during our Reformation emphasis about the importance, what a monumental translation Tyndale's was, how influential it was, what an important piece of work it was. 1526, Tyndale has it like this. Which son, being the brightness of his glory and the very image of his substance. Now, it was brought to my attention not too long ago that I've been slacking on giving you some Greek words week to week. I sort of set a standard and then I dropped off for a while. But I mean, look, some weeks I'm doing Old Testament. So I mean, what do you want from me? I'm about to make up for that, right here. All right, I'm gonna make good. This section of this verse that we looked at in multiple versions just now is about as fascinating as any anywhere because it has in it three Greek terms that are found nowhere else. So they're unique one-time usages. You look them up in the old lexicon, it just says like a little one next to it, you know, like number of usages, one. Now the last of them we'll look at has there's a variant other form of it that gets used a couple of times in 1 Corinthians. But the other two aren't even found anywhere else. They're only here in Hebrews. And I want to look at all of them. Now, the first one I won't spend as much time on. That's the one that said the radiance or the brightness of the glory of God. The radiance or the brightness. Well, let's set that one aside. I want to look at the other two. The main ones I want to focus on here. The one that's image or imprint, and then the other one that's being or person or substance. So we're going to have a look at these two. So you want Greek? I'll give you Greek. And isn't this interesting? The first of these words here, the one that's for imprint, or some of the translations said the express image or the exact representation. And yeah, you're seeing it correctly. It is in fact the word character. That is right. You see it right. The word is character. The little chi, you know, the little X looking thing. It's the CH, kind of the hard K, right? With the ha, right? Ah, right? Makes you want to clear your throat. That is the word character. It is where our word character comes from. It's just not a coincidence. And look at its meaning. I just pasted this right off of an online lexicon. Look at where it comes from. It gives you a little indication of the background of it. That back in the day, and I mean really back in the day, not like when you were in junior high, I mean like way back in the day, the use of the word, where it comes from, is from the art of, or the practice of, engraving or etching things. And so there's a verb carasso, which means to scratch or etch or carve or engrave, and later to stamp. And so the noun here is, it can be the tool that's used for it, or like in this case, the thing that's made, the impression made, the carving, the engraving, the stamp, the image. Now that helps you understand the word better, doesn't it? And it's an interesting word. Like I said, it's not used other places like this. So in a lot of Paul's letters, and like we said before, I mean, Paul could have written this. Some think he did. It's questionable. But in all the letters we know to be from Paul, when he talks about the image of Christ, he always uses this Greek word icon. E-I-K-O-N is what it would look like. Icon. Like in, you know, Colossians, he says Christ is the image of the invisible God. It's icon. He does it over and over. He never uses this word. This is a very unique and one-time way to use this. Now, this word will show up in other Greek outside of the Bible. You know, I mean, obviously it's a common word. The writer of Hebrews didn't insert it and say, no one will know what this is, I just made it up. No, he's using a word people would know, even though it's not commonly used by other writers in the New Testament. But you get a picture, right? And incidentally, you get a good picture about the word character, the way we use it. Because in fact, he's even using it in this verse in a metaphorical way, right? He's not being literal. He's not using the old literal meaning where it comes from. He's not saying that Christ is a physical imprint or stamp or a, you know, something carved in the literal sense. It's metaphorical. Just like it's metaphorical the way the word character has come down to us, because one of the ways we use the word character, is it not one of the ways we use it to refer to kind of a person's deeper, truer person, like who you really, really are, the deeper, truer image of you, not the shallow, right? Not what you look like, not how you appear. Well, he looks like a nice person. Well, he has an honest look about him. What? That's all exterior. But if we talk about a person's character, we're talking about, if you will, what is etched deeper, right? We're talking about what is stamped deeper on you. The real person, the deeper inner stamp of who you really are. Not just the shallow sort of window dressing. And so we use the word character, and it has this background, this etymology, as they say. That's where the word came from. And so here we find it packed with all this kind of theological meaning, saying that this is who the Messiah is. He is, in fact, the character of God. That's why I chose that weird-looking title. Some of you look at the title and you're like, huh? Christ is the character of God's substance. I ain't never heard that from the Bible. Well, no translator put it exactly that way, did they? Although, I did see the word character in one of them, and I saw the word substance in Tyndale. So, and that's the next word we're looking at. But, you know, usually, because it would make, if you just said to someone, Christ is the character of God's substance, which would be more transliterating the exact Greek words, I mean, the average English speaker would go, huh? It's hard enough to get your head around the exact representation of his being. There's enough debate we could have just about what the express image or imprint of his person is, let alone saying the character of his substance. But those do reflect the Greek terms. So that's the first one, the character, the imprint. Now I got one more. I told you I'm doubling down for you here today. Here's our second word. And this one's even juicier. And I'm just cut and pasting here. Here it is. It is hypo. It's coming soon. Don't worry. Sneak previews. One of these old days, coming around the corner, the slide will transition. Yes, sir. I told you it would. See, just flawlessly and like magic. Someone get him some coffee. All right. Here it is. Hypostasis. I'm just giving you the English one right there, if you can read it. Or with the little accent, hypostasis. I ain't never heard of that. Now, the Greek up there has a little U, hypostasis. What's the difference in the U and the Y? I don't know, but every time you take the little U in Greek, the upsilon, and it goes over and it transliterates to English, it always turns into a Y. I don't know why. Just some reason. Some reason I never studied, but it turns into a Y. So, and it's got the little breathing mark, which makes it a hard breath, which makes it an H. That's why we put an H on it. So, you have the word in the Greek there, hypostasis. When it comes over and it transliterates, it looks like hypostasis. Now, you look at it and you go, wait a minute. I've seen hypo words before. I kind of recognize that little Greek thing on there that says hypo. And you do recognize it from other fancy words you might have used before. Fancy English words that take that word. So what does it mean? Where is it from? Well, it's a compound. So the second part of it is this word stasis, which has to do with standing. It's from a verb histamine, to stand. So it's like something stable. You know, if something is static, it's like it's fixed, it's there. So it has to do with the standing, static, you know, essence of a thing. And a little hypo is a little, little prepositional thing that's stuck on the front. And we have a lot of words that have to do with hyper versus hypo, right? Now, medical people are like, oh yeah, lots of medical words like that. Hyper, like over or too much, and hypo, not enough or under. Some of you might be, I don't know, hyperactive, or you're hypoglycemic, right? Or you only use hyper or hypoallergenic, whichever one it is you're supposed to do. We got a lot of hypers and hypos, and so you're familiar with it. So here you have the idea of that which stands under. So that's why it puts it there for you. A foundation. So when you bring this exact term into Latin, it's the same word. Hypo in Latin would be sub, like under, and stasis would be like stantia. So substantia, that sounds kind of familiar. That's why I said the character of God's substance. And of course you see it even among the definitions there. The substantial quality, nature of a person or thing. And here is that second term. So there it is. There is the Greek that lies behind what all those translators are doing with that verse. The character of God's substance. So it's the imprint of his nature. It's the representation of his substance. It's the likeness of his being or his essence. It's the stamp. You see what they're doing. Those are the two words. But now, okay, fine, well and good. Isn't that just all well and interesting? Class dismissed. But look, why does it matter? Why does it matter? This verse is just jammed with serious theology. I mean, Christian belief, what makes Christian belief unique, what we believe about Christ, is really, you know, in that snippet right there, just with these terms alone. In fact, if it said that nowhere else, to say it this way would almost be, I don't know, shocking to some people. I think it was in the first century. I think some people probably said it was blasphemous. What? How can you say, I mean, he may be great, he may be really important, he may be prophetic, he may be wise, he may be morally upstanding, he may be a lot of wonderful, fine, upstanding things, but you can't call him that. I mean, the very imprint of the substance or nature of God, what? Wednesday we were kind of dealing with the Jehovah's Witness understanding of God, and we were saying that like certain groups, they don't have the Trinitarian, you know, the Orthodox historic understanding of God. They sort of have a tweaked version that looks different. And so we sort of got into this idea of how, you know, the history of trying to understand the triune nature of God. But part of our understanding comes right from a passage just like this. So I'll tell you just how important this word even is in the history of the church. And for that, let me just give you a brief little history lesson. So the church was planted in all kinds of places and growing and thriving and moving right along. And then there were leaders in these different churches in different places, and letters would go between them and all kinds of things would happen. But then errors would creep up, and there would be controversy, and there would be some teachers that would teach this or that, and they would try to answer it. And one of the solutions to this was every once in a very rare while, they would call a giant council. Let's get Christian leaders together in a city, and let's spend usually months talking about where we stand and really carefully hammering out correct biblical belief so that we can sort of say, okay, we all agree on this, boys. All right, now let's preach and teach the unified message and make sure we're, you know, trying to handle it correctly and be free from strange errors and strange teachings. So there was this belief that came in early on, and around the 3rd and 4th century, there was a guy named Nestorius. And he had become a popular teacher, and what he had said, he had been teaching that Christ was actually two people and had two natures. I mean, we have to distinguish between natures and body. This gets a little complicated, but what Nestorius was actually saying was that there are two persons. You have a divine person called the Christ, eternal, divine, powerful. And then you just have this guy, Jesus, and he's just a regular guy. And what you have is two people, but they had to, for a while, they had to share a body. They shared a body. Two people shared a body. The divine guy and the not divine guy shared a body. That was what Nestorius was teaching. I'm just trying to understand this. But a lot of the people in the early church said, time out there, Nestorius. I'm not sure that's exactly the right way to understand the Bible teaching. One of the people that sought to correct this and tried to come against this was another guy. And this other guy's name was Eutychus. And Eutychus said, no, you've got it all wrong, you see. The deal is, there's only one nature. There's only one nature. Christ has one nature, and it's divine. But there was just a little bit of humanity in it. And the way he put it was, he said, the humanity would dissolve like a drop of honey in the sea. There's just enough humanity to make him almost kind of seem like a human person. But really wasn't. And they called this group who followed him the Monophysites. Monophysis, one nature. So, in the year 451, there was a large church council held in a place called Chalcedon. Chalcedon, which is a coastal city of what was called Bithynia in Asia Minor. Today it's Turkey. And lots of Christians. And by the way, this area had had Christians a long time, had a long history with a church put there. There had been notable martyrs in the city of Chalcedon. There was a pretty thriving church. So they all met there to decide several things. But one of the things they had to deal with at Chalcedon was, what do we do with this business about the nature of Christ? And here's this guy teaching this. So here's what they came up with. They came up with using a word. And in the council, when it was all said and done, they had formulated a statement. This is what they did, right? This is what they did at Nicaea as well, right? So this statement, though, instead of the Nicene Creed, which is what came out of the Council of Nicaea, you end up with this Chalcedonian-type creed, or the definition of Chalcedon, which is supposed to kind of carefully explain the nature of Christ. And here's what they said. They said he has two natures, but but he's one person with two natures. Two natures inconfusedly, unchangeably, indivisibly, and inseparably together. Because they like words a lot. And they're hooked on adverbs. So they said, they're just trying to drive the point home. So now you can say, man, this is some confusing theology, because we're talking about Trinitarianism. You're talking about like three persons who share one substance. And here you got Jesus, and he's one person, but he has two natures, huh? But where did they come up with this goofy idea? They used a term. They used a term, and it's the term hypostatic union. Which, by the way, is a cool band name. If you get a band together and you just don't have a name and you're just wondering, I mean, hypostatic union, I'm just throwing it out. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Hypostatic Union? And then it would be like, dun, 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 dun. I don't know what style it would be, but I just looked at Jim and then I thought, I'll throw him a bone. And people would start banging their heads, but Hypostatic Union, huh? Why? What's the deal? See, where'd they get such a fruity sounding term? I mean, why have we got to talk about these theologians with Hypostatic Union? You will hear this used. Theologians will use it talking about the nature, the two natures of Christ. They exist in a hypostatic union. Well, I don't believe in all these crazy terminology. I just want to know whatever the Bible says. Why you got to think up all these theological terms? Why can't we just go with what the Bible says? But you see, the boys at Chalcedon were just trying to use a term right out of the text. They just, you know, I mean, they lived in a time when Greek was still spoken in lots of places, and so it was still a little more handy to them. And so they looked in Hebrews, and what did they see? They saw, Christ as the very character or imprint of the hypostasis of God, of the substance, the nature of the... And they said, yeah, let's use that term to describe this. Let's be biblical about it after all, and let's just go ahead and use the writer of Hebrews wants to use that word. He's inspired. We'll use that word. And so they did. So they said, this is how it was. Well, what's that matter? What's that matter to us, for crying out loud? I mean, can't we just believe in Jesus? Well, I hope. I hope you do. But who are you believing in after all anyway? Because as we've been talking about on Wednesday nights, other people sort of believe in Jesus too. And if I just take no thought of who I'm dealing with, who he is, I know nothing or little about him, then I might find myself believing in something called Jesus or someone who I give that name to. But I may have a very confused, distant, convoluted, very unbiblical understanding of who I actually claim I believe in. And so as best we can, if we are ardent disciples, if we care, if we want to know, who am I praying to? What is he like? Then I want to try to go to the source of where that information comes from. And I go to the inspired writing and I ask the writers, tell me who he is. You know better than I know. Tell me, apostolic writers, who is this person? How do I understand him? And this is what they reveal. And so let's be a church that is as Christ-centered as these writers, as our text is. Be Jesus people and know who we're talking about. And remember that we are talking about and we are believing in and we are named after and we pray to someone who is not just the great prophet and not just wise and not just morally perfect and all those great things, but someone who in fact is the exact imprint or character of the very essence or substance of God.
That whatever things are lovely, whatever things are true, whatever things are of good report, if they're being heard, you know, let us think upon these things. Let God be true and never man a liar. And that is what it comes down to.